At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. The last episode of this show was about what Reimagining Liberty is. With frequent guest Corey Massimino, I talked about the values and perspective behind Reimagining Liberty's approach to liberalism and how it's distinct from right libertarianism. Today's episode is a nice companion to that, not just because it also features a frequent guest, this time my friend Matt McManus, but because it runs further with the theme of distinctions, namely, in this case, the ideas of the anti-liberalism of the far right. Our topic is the contemporary right-wing canon, the thinkers whose ideologies have come to dominate and whose writings are giving form to the authoritarian fascism challenging liberal values and virtues. Matt McManus is an assistant professor at Spelman College and the author of The Rise of Postmodern Conservatism and The Political Theory of Liberal Socialism, among many other books. If you value Reimagining Liberty, consider becoming a patron. You won't just be helping us keep the lights on, but you'll also get a special version of the podcast that is free of ads and sponsorships, and you'll get to listen to new episodes a week early. You can also join the Reimagining Liberty Discord community. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. And if you just want to stay updated about this podcast and my writing, head to that same Patreon and click join for free. You'll get notified when I publish a new essay or release a new episode, and you'll get sneak peeks at upcoming shows. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Matt. The American right has, over the last, call it, 10 years, changed quite a lot. Not just tactically, not just from a policy standpoint, but ideologically. And I was thinking as we were going into this that it feels like there are a lot of people, particularly kind of more establishment sorts, who think that the thinkers on the right that they are still in dialogue with or arguing with are basically Milton Friedman, Bill Buckley, Barry Goldwater, that those are the ideas, because that's the ideas of the conservatism that they grew up around, the pre-Trump conservatism. And this sometimes manifests in either a lack of understanding or a lack of willingness to recognize just how extreme the right has become ideologically. You know, we look at like the DHS and White House Twitter accounts, and someone will say like, these are being run by 23-year-old neo-Nazis, like literal Nazis. And you're like, no, it can't really be, because that's like not the kind of right that I'm used to. It is the Friedman and Buckley and Barry Goldwater and so on. And so I wanted to bring you on to talk about like what the right's ideology actually is now and who are the thinkers that they are drawing on. So maybe we start with just how much have things changed?
Well, it's a very good and very complicated question, right? At the outset of the Trump administration, the first one, a lot of people were devotees of what we might call the break theory, the idea that there was a radical break with traditional conservatism or the traditional conservative movement, and then Trumpism or MAGAism was consequently some kind of freak aberration. This was the position you saw advanced by people like Jonah Goldberg or George Will in his book, The Conservative Sensibility. To some extent, Bill Kristol, Once Upon a Time, you get the idea, right? The notion being that once upon a time, American conservatism was basically a kind of conservative form of liberalism dedicated to a small state and a fair amount of personal liberty, albeit, you know, ordered liberty. and that had all been pushed aside by these radicals and extremists. More contemporaneously, what we've seen people stress is actually that there's more of a continuity with the old right than was initially presupposed. These are people like David Austin Walsh, for example, the famous historian who points out that if you even go back to Barry Goldwater, right, you can find people like the Birchers, for example, who were touting conspiracy theories about how Dwight Eisenhower, of all people, was a secret communist and consequently needed to be removed from office. Or you can even look at people like George Wallace, for example, you know, the famous governor of Alabama, who famously, you know, used to stand in front of universities saying, you know, blacks will get in here over my dead body, that kind of thing. And the continuity thesis did not suggest that there's nothing that's changed with MAGA, that it's just the same old, same old. But instead, what it stresses is that latent tendencies on the American right are streams of thought that were present in the American right that were once comparatively marginal or fringe have now moved on to the mainstream. And that's one thing that I want to be clear about from the outset, because it's important to stress that these things didn't come out of nowhere. You know, they didn't spontaneously emerge, as it were. They were there if you were paying attention and knew where to look. People like San Francis, for example, who we'll get into, or Buchanan.
But there does seem to be some degree of a break, or I suppose, is it less a break and more a matter of degree? Because it is the case that a lot of the older thinkers, or the people who were, I guess, the drivers of mainstream conservatism pre-Trump, were not these weird neo-pagans that we see. They were not openly monarchist. They were not Russian fascists or semi-fascists or at least fascism-adjacent thinkers. Is that wrong then? Like, were things like that, ideas like that, more part of the right-wing ideological landscape than many of us assumed, or are those new ideas that have risen up? Or is it just that there's always a kind of shifting degree of like who has the most emphasis at any moment? So there's this like general miasma of thinkers broadly on the right, and some are salient at one time and some are salient at another.
I think that you could say it's a little bit of both, right? To cop out a little bit, right? But there's a reason I say that, right? I mean, let's just take two examples, Pat Buchanan and Samuel Francis, right? Both of those are thinkers who really started to gain a reputation in the 1970s and 1980s for what at the time were considered fairly extremist views. But since then, a lot of those views have moved mainstream. So when I say that there's continuity there, I'm not suggesting that the views of Buchanan and Francis were anywhere like mainstream conservatism in the 1980s under the Reagan administration. What I'm saying is they were there and they were present in propagating those ideas. Just what was once considered a fairly fringe part of the American conservative movement has now become very much mainstream. So just to give, you know, two examples, right? Pat Buchanan, right? Famously, you know, worked in the Reagan administration, extraordinarily erudite guy. And if you read his books on The Decline of the West or Suicide of the Superpower or Churchill's War, what comes through is this extraordinary set of anxieties about things like demographic decline that very much anticipate what emerged with Trumpism. So, you know, Buchanan is one of the first to really articulate these deep, even existential anxieties about swarms of Mexican migrants coming into the country. And he's very overt that the problem with them is that they're not white, right? He acknowledges that they're Catholic, but that's not good enough to be part of the club, right? And he says, given contemporary American birthrights among European Americans, and, you know, the greater birth rate and influx of migrants coming from the third world, white America is soon going to be a thing in the past. So what we need is a much stronger immigration policy coupled with, you know, populist demagoguery in order to prevent this. Buchanan used to famously agree with people like Francis that he thought that the largest untapped reservoir of political support in the United States was to the right of Ronald Reagan, right? And it's eventually what Trump tried to tap into himself. Or if you want, you could go even more extreme. Samuel Francis, right? Francis was a very well-established conservative intellectual in the 1980s. He published a well-received collection of essays with the university press, Beautiful Losers. And more or less, he was considered pretty much an intellectual leader, albeit to the right of most Reaganites, up until the 1990s, where I started overtly touting white nationalism and frankly, Nazism and fascist politics, where he was subsequently marginalized, but always maintained kind of a cult following on the right, and has since become restored to his place of preeminence in many right-wing circles. So for those who don't know, Francis, again, worked during the Reagan administration, typically argued that the biggest problem with the Reagan administration was that it was far too liberal, made too many concessions to the goals of the left, and strongly suggest that middle American radicals were one day going to take back their country from this combination of elites in the Democratic Party and elites in the Republican Party, who for the most part were all just liberals by whatever color you wanted to call them. And when he wrote Beautiful Losers, about midway through his career, it was still unclear who these middle American radicals were going to be. But by the time you get to the 1990s, he's very clear about what he means is white people, right? When people are going to take back a country, they're going to impose far more strict immigration policies. They're going to undo the legacy of the civil rights movement. That was a crucial part of his program. And he also points out, I'm sorry to say, that he wants to reestablish things like segregation, where he says, look, there's no reason that blacks in America shouldn't possess certain kinds of civil rights, for example, rights to private property, rights to employment. But why bother giving them political rights? They're only going to use that to vote for liberal policies. And this is supposed to be a white person's country anyway. So if they're going to be here, then they're not going to enjoy the full benefits of citizenship. So these are just two examples, and I can multiply them, of important figures on the American right who were always present and always had an influence, but they were considered marginal up until, you know, Trump rode down that golden elevator when all of a sudden people started cracking open those books again and realizing that they really anticipated a lot of what was going to come to the fore.
So that's Pat Buchanan. That's Samuel Francis. Those are like old guard thinkers, right? Like Pat Buchanan was a regular on the McLaughlin Group, which was the kind of show that, like, my parents' generation was watching, you know.
Still alive somehow, though. You know, what they say, evil never dies.
That's true. The Reagan administration was a while ago. Like, who are the novel thinkers now? Who are the main drivers of, say, like, if you want to understand kind of the very online far right that seems to have somehow taken over the country, who are the names that are central to the way that they view themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question. And here I think there are layers that we need to talk about, right? On the more mainstream end of things, you have people like Adrian Vimule, Patrick Deneen, Yoram Hazony. And these are figures who usually emerge from out of the academic world, or the world of, you know, more mainstream think tanks. And they're overtly illiberal. They make no bones about that. And sometimes, as in the case with Vermeule, they'll dally with fascist intimations, right? Vermeule is very, very overt about the kind of Schmidian undercurrents to his approach to politics and law, which are for the most part one and the same as far as he's concerned, right? But there's still this desire for a certain kind of mainstream respectability. You know, they publish in magazines like First Things that have kind of glossy covers to them. They'll still release books with academic presses. And people like Deneen and Hazony certainly are more willing to say that what they want to do is preserve democracy. They just don't want to preserve liberalism. In fact, sometimes in more ambitious moments, I'll even suggest that a commitment to liberalism is contrary to a commitment to democracy if you have large conservative majorities that want to advance illiberal policies. Right? Vermeule, I should also add, is the more extreme amongst that trio, is also the one that's most willing to sit there and say democracy has a purely instrumental value and certainly liberalism needs to go. So, you know, if democracy winds up producing majorities of people that are committed to what he calls the common good, then fine, we can keep it. If majorities of people don't want the common good, then, well, they're wrong. So, you know, we need to use autocratic powers to push for that. Unfortunately, and I'm sure for a lot of your listeners, that sounds bad enough, there are far darker things out there, certainly in the online, right? This is where you encounter people like Bronze Age Pervert or Raw Egg Nationalist, Lomez, or mentions Molbug, Curtis Yarvin, all those types. And what's distinctive about them is just how much more overtly anti-democratic they are than even the fellows that I mentioned before, and also how much more willing they are to connect their views to the most toxic iterations of right-wing politics that we've seen historically. Things like fascism, either in its Italian or German variant, certainly the most militant forms of reactionary, illiberal monarchism that emerged throughout the 19th century, you name it. I'll stop there and we can break them down one by one if you want. But like I said, if a lot of attention has been paid to Hazzoni, Dineen, Vermeule, included by me, right? And I think that they're all worthy of interrogation, but there are more sinister things out there.
Well, let's start with Bronze Age pervert. I remember, I think this was during the first Trump administration. I remember some, it was a White House staffer said to a journalist that Bronze Age pervert's book, which Bronze Age Mindset, I believe, was the thing being read by a significant number of the junior staffers in the first Trump administration, which sounds crazy because it seems like no one would take a guy who goes around calling himself Bronze Age pervert seriously, and yet many do. So what is his thing?
Well, it's important to note that he is taken very seriously, right? Allegedly, Curtis Yarvin mentions Lobog, you know, to hold up copies of Bronze Age Mindset like it was the Bible, right? And since Yarvin is an influence on the vice president now, right, you know, we need to understand that these people, as odd as they might seem, carry real clout. So Bronze Age pervert is Costin El Mariu, right? That hasn't been officially confirmed, but it's been all but officially confirmed. Costin El Mariu grew up middle, upper middle class by most accounts. He went to very, very good elite universities and received a PhD in political theory. And he later published his thesis on selective breeding, which is, to make a long story short, kind of a Nietzschean Straussian reading of Plato that essentially argues, amongst other things, that Plato couldn't have actually endorsed the idea that justice is more important than power and tyranny, because the arguments he gives for it are just so bad that there must be a kind of ironic intention behind this, right? Which is where the kind of Straussian dimensions of this come in. He's most famous for the 2018 book, Bronze Age Mindset. I think it was 2018, that was published under the pseudonym Bronze Age Pervert. And this is a pretty hard book to describe. I'd say go read it for yourself, but really don't. The closest analog that I can think to would be something like William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. It's a collection of anecdotes, stories, short essays, epigraphs, and even maxims that rail against, you damn it, the bugmen, who are the kind of ordinary mass of people who lack any kind of mobility, or the roasties. I apologize, but if you want to know what a roastie is, it's a slang term that he developed for women. That's a reference to female genitalia. Interpret that how you will, right? And by and large, if you read the book carefully, a couple of themes come through. The main one is BAP is deeply concerned about the demasculization of our society, largely foregrounded by women, or at least extremely effeminate kind of cultural norms. And he, what he wants is to restore this noble aristocratic warrior ethic to the heart of our civilization as he understands it. And he makes no bones about it, right? That this is going to have directly fascistic connotations. And you know, that's not me reading into this. In a 2021 essay, he described himself as a fascist or something worse, kind of in the vein of Evola, right? In the sense of liking a lot of what fascists had to offer, but thinking that classical fascism was too democratic.
Who is this kind of thinking for? We can imagine why it's appealing to young men looking for their place in the world, concerned about their status, feeling the same kind of attraction and anxiety about women that a lot of young men do. Certainly not at the top of the power structure yet. But feeling invigorated and vital and so on. Like, all of that makes sense. But it also seems like the kind of ideas that had you expressed them in conservative circles 20 years ago, you would have been laughed at as a crank. And it ran, I mean, this was stuff that was appearing anonymously. It was appearing online in blogs. There's a similar thing with Curtis Yarvin. As you mentioned, like, he got his start blogging as Mencius Moldbug. These are like outside of what we think of as the traditionally gate-kept areas of philosophical production and engagement and dissemination and so on. Why did they suddenly start having influence? Because there's always been weird fringe ideas on the internet. You know, there used to be the old website Time Cube that was a lot of fun to read and was by a crank who I don't even want to get into his weird ideas because I don't know that I could explain them in anything that made sense. But like that stuff's always been around, but suddenly it seems like it's getting taken seriously in a way that it wouldn't have before. Curtis Yarvin would not have been taken seriously by people in positions of power and leadership because his work, I mean, his arguments are bad. It's just weird crankery and so on. Like, it feels like something there has also changed, but I don't know quite what beyond just kind of gesturing in the direction of the internet.
Well, there's a lot to say there, right? I'll break this down into three parts. The first one would be talking about, you know, the continuities with other streams of conservatism, then I'll talk about his contemporary peer, and then why don't we move on to Yarvin. Elements of this kind of macho militarism have always been present on the American right, and I would also add in parts of the Democratic Party as well, right? You know, I'm old enough to remember the war in Iraq when people like Karl Rove would infamously say that individuals in the fact-based community didn't realize that members of the Bush administration were history's actors because they were an empire now, and an empire gets to create its own reality, and historians would only sit there and transcribe what history's actors were doing, right? Or even a fairly moderate person like Jonah Goldberg, for example, who's now a pretty militantly anti-Trumpist. In the 2000s, he wrote an article where he said every 20 years, the United States should pick a small country and go to war with it just to remind everyone who's the boss, right? So again, I want to stress, it's not like this wasn't present before, and it could certainly bubble to the surface during moments of jingoistic militarism. But this brings me to our second point. I think that what's unique about Bath and what makes him appealing is he was very well suited to tapping into a lot of those longstanding sentiments in a way that made sense in the digital age, and that was going to especially be appealing to young people. In my article on him for Commonweal, I compared reading Bronze Age Mindset to what used to feel like listening to old Eminem records, right? You know, there was this combination of trollish adulation where if people got offended by it and if people took issue with what you were saying, that was seen almost as a positive because you were galvanizing attention. And since these are people who really desire a kind of attention for their alleged nobility and superior status, et cetera, this is a fairly good substitute. But I also think that one of the problems is that things like BAPism resonate when we have an economy and a society where many young men don't feel that they have opportunities available to them, where they are looking for someone to blame, where there's a lack of positive role models for them to aspire to emulate. And so consequently, they turn to the darkest impulses that are always latent within all of us. So I think that when you read a lot of these authors, it can be very easy, as you point out, to just dismiss what they say as nonsense. And I want to be clear. Bob doesn't have an argumentative leg to stand on, nor do I think he pretends to, right? This is meant to be a kind of aesthetic work rather than an argumentative one. But, you know, you need to also ask yourself why this stuff appeals to people and why it appeals to so many people if you're going to be able to confront it effectively. Just sitting there, as I'm prone to doing as well, and saying, well, here's all the factual errors he makes and here's how his prescriptions, such as they are ridiculous, isn't going to go very far. I should also add, just since we're on this channel, I think BAP is interesting, and this will actually segue nicely into Moldbug, because while he's for the most part a Nietzschean, you know, this desire for self-assertion, masculine energy, selective breeding, a vulgar Nietzschean is probably the more accurate way to put it. He also draws on other important streams of right-wing thought, including right libertarianism, which I know you've written about. So when Javier Milei was elected the president of Argentina, BAP actually endorsed him. That might seem odd given BAP's own very clear authoritarian inclinations. But, you know, BAP made very clear why he was doing this. He said, look, fundamentally what Milei is doing is pushing against the logic of democracy and the logic of egalitarianism by restoring the productive classes of Argentina to their place of preeminence. And he said, by and large, I don't really care very much about the economic programs. That stuff's all boring to me, as it has historically always been for fascists, right? What I care about, again, is this reassertion of the idea of superiority in Argentinian society that for far too long has been undervalued. And that, I think, segues nicely into Curtis Yarbin. So for those who don't know, Yarbin is an odd fellow, let's just put it that way, who draws an eclectic array of influences, but is probably the most preeminent amongst the kind of new right or hard right intellectuals in the United States right now. So he began his career writing under a pseudonym as well, Mencius Molebug, on the blog Unqualified Reservations, where he continuously argued for a reactionary position that, as he once put it, was still angry about the English Civil War. So, you know, most conservatives right now are angry about the civil rights movement. A lot of the more reactionaries are still pissed off about the French Revolution. Mencius Molebug is so much of a reactionary that he's still pissed off that the Civil War happened in England all the way back in the 17th century. And his big theoretical influences are Carlyle, the 19th century reactionary, who used to characterize the advent of liberalism and democracy as an enormous decline from antiquity, particularly with the loss of heroism and the value associated with heroism that he associated with that. But Molebug is also very influenced by right libertarianism, people like Herman Hoppe or Ludwig von Mises or Murray Rothbard. And again, that might seem incompatible with the reactionary dimensions of his thinking. But as, you know, Curtis Yarbin once put it, there is no reason why a libertarian like him, and I quote, couldn't support something like martial law, because ultimately what libertarianism is supposed to be about is preserving respect for property and preserving respect for one's purpose. And when you understand that, right, it becomes very clear why a powerful state that does everything it can to preserve your person and to preserve your property could be compatible with at least his version of libertarianism. And, you know, aligned with that, Mencius Molebug also tends to think of the world in extremely stratified terms down to this day when he writes things about how the masses suck, for example. You know, throughout his work is this consistent injunction that the best thing that could happen to America and really the world is for us to get rid of democracy, replace it with something that looks an awful lot like like a monarchy, because there'd be a CEO in chief appointed who... What candidate is available for the CEO in chief varies depending on when he's writing. But back in the day, it used to be Steve Jobs. Go figure, right? Last time I saw, you know, he had a lot of nice things to say about Elon Musk. You know, one of these kind of tech guru, Joan Galt type figures. And the idea is that, you know, we give them all power, all the power they need to. Ordinary people are freed from politics because they don't have to interfere with it any longer. And he imagines that what we're going to have is a relatively small state, but a very strong state, right? One that has no checks on its capabilities, at least insofar as, you know, it's committed to doing the task that Yarbin thinks government is supposed to do, right? And, you know, you've seen him recently say some things about how it is that the Trump executive branch needs to be more militant in prosecuting its campaign against its enemies, that kind of stuff, which is all very much in line with his philosophy.
Yeah, I think that the dalliances libertarians, particularly right libertarians, have had with these guys historically and in some cases an ongoing way points at this interesting like fault line in the process by which libertarians forget that they ought to be liberals or forget about liberalism in, you know, because libertarianism is historically can be pinned as like an outgrowth of the liberal movement. Histories of libertarianism frequently will begin with, say, the Levelers, who were very much concerned with opposition to the kind of hierarchies that these guys, at least we talk about the English Civil War, the Levelers were active in that, looking for, you know, extended suffrage and religious toleration and a more egalitarian approach. But libertarians, some of them, seem to forget this. And I think it's this interesting sense that those hierarchies are natural features of the world. And so you can say, like, if we had a domain of perfect liberty, you would have the people like me at the top, And the fact that people like me are not at the top, or the fact that people who aren't like me are rising into positions equal to my own or threaten to surpass me, is evidence that something's gone wrong with liberty. And therefore, you need the strong state to come in and protect this underlying system of liberty that, if it were real and realized, would position me and others like me at the top. And I think this is why you see a lot of people in this camp are really into evolutionary psychology as a mechanism for explaining differences between men and women. They're very into race and IQ research. I'll say research in quotes, in scare quotes, because all of those are ways to naturalize what they imagine to be the hierarchies that would exist in a domain of perfect liberty. And I think this is why a lot of them cozy up to kind of those right-wing tech bro oligarch types as well, who are seen as, you know, the embodiments of the kind of like success that flows from being this genius person in the market, even though in a lot of cases their wealth is, you know, the product of state subsidies or interventions or rent seeking or other, you know, non-free market pathways to acquire power and resources and so on.
Sometimes they're doing billions of dollars in Musk's case.
Yes, yes. Musk is a product of the state, not of the free market. But he can tell a story about how he's selling products, and therefore it looks like a product of the market and not of the state.
Well, if I could just follow up on what you said, I think that you're absolutely right. And there was something that you said in a class of mine once that really resonated with me that I think actually captures what you're describing very well, which is that for many left or bleeding heart or liberal libertarians, let's call them that, right? Fundamentally, there was this idea that the state is the single biggest inhibitor of liberty for all and equality for all. Because if we get rid of the state, then free interactions, including in the market, will uplift everyone, if not to the same level, because it seems pretty dreary, right? At least to a reasonable level of affluence and flourishing, right? And I think that coming from a liberal socialist perspective, we might have disagreements about how to go about achieving that vision. You know, I've been pretty vigorous in proposing the Nordic model as one that people should advance. But by and large, I think our aspiration is pretty similar, right? To empower ordinary people, including the least among us, because that's the just thing to do. By contrast, a lot of right libertarians of the sort people like Mencius Moelbug, or for that matter, BAP, lean in on, saw the market as effectively a kind of Spencerian sorting machine to winnow the winners from the losers. And the state, the biggest problem with the state, consequently, is not that it entrenches inequalities and hierarchies through law, but instead that it might give the unworthy a kind of leg up where they don't belong. And that's exactly the argument that you see made in things like the bell curve, which is the important touchstone that a lot of these figures will draw upon. Certainly, you know, it was hugely influential. Because what are Herrnstein and Murray's basic argument, right? It's that the big state that emerged under the Johnson administration has tried to give blacks and others a leg up through various welfare programs because they are not able to compete in the market the way everyone else does. But what we should show through IQ research, and I put that in square quotes as well, is that there is no actually uplifting these people because their inferiority is just baked into their genetics. So consequently, this is just a waste of money. And as Murray never tired to say, it's time for America to live again with inequality, by which he meant, you know, a market-ish society, and I say ish for reasons that we can get into, where there's going to be enormous amounts of inequality, and clearly this is going to be stratified by race, but that's all natural and there's nothing much that can be done about it. And I think if that's the idea of liberty, and again, to put that in scare quotes, that you're operating on, you shouldn't be surprised when you start drifting in a more rightward direction, because as Hayek would put it, this conviction that they're recognizably superior persons, and the best society is the one that allows those recognizable superior persons to get as much as they possibly can, is fundamentally a conservative rather than a liberal impulse.
And I think this is also why you see so many people kind of, as they move along this path, continue to shed more and more of their libertarian commitments. And by libertarian commitments, I mean the just kind of thin libertarian, the state should respect liberty and only protect it and not intervene and be minimal. they tend to give up on a lot of those because I think they're wrong about the nature of liberty and a free society and a free market, that a genuinely free society and free markets don't tend to have the effects that they think they do, but instead have the opposite. They tend to dissolve hierarchies. They tend to dissolve traditional power structures. They tend to redistribute concentrations of wealth in the sense that it's hard to maintain enormous concentrations of wealth in a genuinely free market because people are competing with you and eventually other people out-innovate you or tastes, preferences shift and your consumer base moves on to other things. And so the kind of concentrations of power and wealth that they imagine are the result of markets aren't. And so therefore, when markets and a free society start dissolving the power structures that they like, they tend to turn on markets. And I think this is the story of why so much of the right's free enterprise rhetoric that was very popular in the, you know, the mid-20th century and kind of up through the rise of Trump went away entirely, is because they liked talking a good game about free markets so long as like the social issues were still broadly conservative and so long as the social hierarchies still privileged them. But when it became clear that one of the things markets do is empower the people at the bottom or enable the people at the bottom to get out of those hierarchies, they tended to turn on them. And you got the kind of rise of populist economics. You got more calls for intervention. You got demands that the universities be brought to heel because those are engines of left-wing cultural hegemony. There was a turning against liberty because I think they misdiagnosed what liberty looks like in practice, that most people in practice, if they are free, do not choose to live the lifestyle that Bronze Age pervert wants to live, or at least says he wants to live. They don't tend to choose the lifestyle that Curtis Yarvin wants. They don't choose to live in the societies or social groups that a Pat Buchanan longs for. They tend to choose the kind of stuff we see in like our dynamic liberal cosmopolitan cities. They tend not to be discriminatory. And so I can see, I guess now to like answer my earlier question, I can see the appeal of these guys because they're like giving voice to these cultural, social, economic anxieties and offering what sounds like a solution. And sometimes in a language that you can kind of talk yourself into thinking, I'm still committed to my principles. It's just these guys are telling me that I need to protect the right things from the people who are actually seeking to undermine.
No, absolutely. And I think that part of this actually is less explained theoretically and more explained historically and culturally, right? I remember when the 2024 election was going on, there were an enormous number of libertarians and classical liberals that I know that said things like, boy, I can't wait for Trump to get booted or to lose this election so I can go back to hating on the woke left, which is what I normally like to do, right? And look, I have my own criticisms of woke culture. You know, I review for Unpopulist of Musa Algarbi's We Have Never Been Woke, which I think actually summarizes a lot of my own kind of reservations about it, right? But I think that if that's the kind of attitude that you're adopting, which is that by and large, the left and these kinds of progressive cultural movements are our real enemy. And these kinds of right-wing aberrations are just that. We just need to inoculate ourselves against them and they'll go away. That's not really confronting the fact that the right is its own distinct movement. It is willing to operationalize the language of liberty where it is to its advantage, but is also willing to drop the language of liberty if they think that the wrong forms of social hierarchy are being established through people's free transactions. And, you know, we don't need to speculate about this. Ron DeSantis wrote a very good book, good in the sense of informative, about these kinds of mindsets, not good in the sense of it's actually of any literary value. I thought it was actually a really boring, self-congratulatory tome. The Courage to Be, right? And he's talking about his policy approaches in Florida. And he's talking about the shot. He's had a long section about the shot hurled around the world, which is extremely grandiose rhetoric. But what he's referring to is his administration's war on Disney. And he very tellingly, he says, look, normally we would say that a big corporation like Disney should be allowed to advance an LGBTQ agenda if that's what it wants, right? But, you know, there are points where it is important for the state to intervene in order to prevent the outcomes of free market transactions if there are higher values at play here. And so, of course, that's exactly what DeSantis did when he went to town against Disney World and Mickey Mouse. And there are more extreme examples of this as well, right? To a fascist like BAP, right? It's not that markets don't have a value, again, if they produce the right kind of hierarchies, in the case of somebody like Javier Milei, right? But this idea that personal liberty and mutually beneficial transactions are the highest aim that we should aim for as a society seem to them to be kind of a spiritual dead end, because really there are more aristocratic and noble values that we should be looking to uphold that require aristocratic and noble people. And if markets get in the way of those kinds of people having the power they need to, then the idea is you're so much the worse for markets.
Can you talk a bit about how this strain of right-wing thinkers uses ideas from the people who look to be their ideological opponents? You mentioned, I mean, we've talked about how they can use free market rhetoric to advance their interests, even if they have no firmly grounded commitment to markets. But they also have a tendency, a lot of these guys, to say, pull ideas from critical theorists, from Marxists, from other kind of versions of left theory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll give a very good example of that. Sam Francis, right? So Sam Francis is in a long line of white supremacist American thinkers. You know, people used to say that John C. Calhoun was the Marx of the masterclass, for example. And certainly Francis would warrant that title in the 20th century, in the early 21st century. And, you know, Francis was always very overt about being inspired by Antonio Gramsci, for example, or Karl Marx himself. However, and I want to be clear about this, he fundamentally disagreed with their moral and political aspirations. What he thought was valuable in their examination was an understanding of how power, especially economic power and cultural power, operates. So just to give an example, in Francis's biggest book, Leviathan and Its Enemies, he draws on various Gramscian themes to say, look, the Marxists and the critical theorists are right that most politics is downwind of culture. And if you change the culture, you'll change the society. Where the Marxists are fundamentally wrong is in assuming that it's the capitalists and the conservatives and the reactionaries that dominate the culture. And so consequently, emancipation is going to mean undoing their control of culture and replacing it with a more democratic approach to, you know, symbolism, artistic reduction, et cetera, et cetera. It's liberals and leftists that are in control of the culture. They gain control out of it, at least according to Francis, through a managerial revolution where they overthrew the old bourgeois and replaced the old bourgeois elite with themselves. And while nominally committed to equality, really what the managers, the liberals, and the leftists are committed to is their own self-advancement, right? You know, Francis is very much a cynic and a Machiavellian in that way. He thinks that no matter how grandiose your political theory happens to be, at root, what you're looking for is power. And so he says, much like Marx had his proletariat that was going to advance against the bourgeoisie, so we on the right are going to have our middle American radicals. Not necessarily the poorest figures in society, because Francis knows that those are predominantly racial minorities who, if anything, he thinks should be worse off than they are right now. Get a load of that, right? It's, you know, middle class, petit bourgeois, middle state conservative radicals who are going to mobilize around white national identity, get rid of the managers, and replace this kind of decadent, liberal, libertine, progressive society with one that is much more conducive to Francis's value system, which means, of course, Aryan, and he uses that term a lot, supremacy, right? Now, I want to be clear. Sometimes I see people depict this using the logic of horseshoe theory, which I still think is probably the worst way of understanding the political spectrum. It does apply in some circumstances. People like Nick Land, for example, definitely move pretty transparently from left to right, with the continuity being contempt for liberalism. But great thinkers from across the political spectrum, or even modest, vulgar thinkers like Francis, draw ideas from a lot of reservoirs, right? And what right-wing Gramscianism does, whether in its de Benoistian form or Francis's form or even Curtis Yarvin, is take the kind of countercultural analysis of the left and commit it to reactionary and hierarchical purposes. Whereas, you know, the value system of the left, and for that matter, liberals, has always been to engage in countercultural agitation for the purposes of emancipating ordinary people from elite control.
There are clearly a lot of liberals who have spent a lot of time, you among them, reading these guys and understanding their thought and their evolving thought out of a scholarly interest or a desire to understand. But how necessary—
I think I'm friends with pretty much all of them at this point.
How necessary is it for the ordinary person who's trying to navigate this political moment? And this political moment is one that is more challenging, I think, for all of us to navigate than any in recent memory. Many of us are feeling a need to engage more deeply in politics than we have in the past because we don't feel we have the luxury of kind of ignoring it because it's certainly not ignoring us. How necessary is it to put the work in to understand these guys? Are there aspects of what's happening now that I suppose are not explicable without a deep understanding of the sorts of thinkers we've discussed today?
Well, I'm enough of a Marxist to say that ultimately structural and political factors are more significant than intellectual factors in determining who has power, right? I think that if you were to suggest that Curtis Yarvin influenced the culture sufficiently, so he laid the seeds for Trump to gain power in 2016, or that Pat Buchanan, by writing book after book, offering low-level apologetics for Hitler, you know, he was really the one that laid the ground. That would just be a nonsensical thesis. I do think, though, that intellectuals do make a difference, which is why rebutting and engaging with them is important. So one of the reasons we should read them, as the podcast goes, is to better know our enemy, so that we can better predict what it is that they're going to do. But I think that the deeper reason for understanding this, and actually this gestures to what we're talking about before we began the episode, is that it's important to understand the appeal of the far right, because they are tapping into something that people feel very strongly, which is this yearning for community, a higher sense of purpose. You could even call it a kind of spiritual outlook on the world. Now, I want to be unambiguously clear. I think that the far right are propagating vulgar, spiritually bankrupt ideas that are leading us on an extraordinarily dark path that is probably going to get darker still, I'm afraid to say. But the need that they're tapping into is very much a real one. And if liberals and progressives and socialists like myself don't find a way of filling it more effectively, then we shouldn't be surprised that people continue to gravitate to those who are offering very bad answers, right? Because at least they're offering something. And this is why I really think that at this moment, what we really need to do as liberals of any stripe, right? Whether we're libertarians or liberal socialists or progressives or Democrat stalwarts, you know, blue, no matter who, is seriously ask ourselves foundational questions about how it is that we can rethink our ideology to make it relevant to a lot of people that just see us as out of touch elitists who don't have a lot of sympathy for ordinary people. And I think that the most dangerous thing that we could do right now, ironically, is to be small C conservatives and just think that we need to stay the course, hope that they make enough mistakes, and then everything will return to normal. I think that what we're really seeing is symptomatic of a failure on the part of liberals to have sufficient imagination to recognize where there were serious aspects, not in our principles, I'd say, but in how those principles are being understood and implemented. And rather like liberalism has rejuvenated itself before in the past, if you think about the 1930s, or for that matter in 1848, we need something very similar at this moment.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.